Let's see what the stew has in store for us today.
Welcome to the Gnomecast, Gnome Stew's tabletop gaming advice podcast. Here we talk to the other gnomes about gaming things to avoid becoming part of the stew, so I guess we'd better be good. But today, you've got me, Jared, with a special interview for you. Would you like to introduce yourself, special interview person?
Hello there. I'm Tracy Sizemore. I'm a game designer, a theatrical lighting designer, a singer, a writer, a podcaster. But today we're talking mostly about my game design stuff, I imagine.
Yeah, I think so. Where might some of our listeners know you from in the gaming space?
Mostly I've worked on Savage Worlds stuff. So, but I've also worked on the Torg Eternity line. So I've written several adventures for Torg Eternity, including the mega adventure called Trifling Matter for the Aurorish Cosm, for anybody who's familiar with it. And then I've done a bunch of Savage Worlds adventures, and I was the developer, one of the developers for Holler and for Pine Box Middle School. I was also involved in the Suede when the new edition, mm-hmm. Savage Worlds Adventure Edition, was being worked on. I sort of pitched the idea of Quick Encounters and helped write that section of the Suede book. So I've been involved with Savage Worlds for a few years now.
Nice. I'm sure Ange can tell you I obsess over monster hunting, among other genres that I get fixated on. That's one of them. So
sure.
Outside the game that we're going to talk about today, what are some of your favorite settings or systems for science fiction?
One of my favorites is the Star Trek 2D20 system.
Oh, yeah, I love that.
I think it's extremely well done for the setting, meaning I think it fits the setting extremely well. I'm not sure about the 2D20 fitting some of the other stuff that they've done, but for Star Trek, it's really good.
Oh, yeah. I had a campaign, and I've been able... I can run games where they're exploring all session and I don't have to worry about anything else and the mechanics work for that. I ran a courtroom session
awesome.
And it worked. Like, it's like, this works so well for Star Trek.
It really does. I haven't had the chance to play like a campaign or anything mm-hmm. of it, but I have played one shots of it at like Gen Con and some other cons, and every time I've enjoyed it, mm-hmm. even when the game master isn't quite super well versed in it, it still just seems to work well enough.
Yeah.
And when they are versed in it, you get that, you know, that flow going, and it really does start to feel like Star Trek. I think it's really well done.
Mm-hmm.
The other one that I would mention is Lost Colony for Savage Worlds. That's the sort of space Deadlands, you know, Deadlands in space for Savage Worlds, for anybody who knows Deadlands. And so I've played that, and I certainly have it. I've referenced it as part of going through Han Cluster because, of course, it's a Savage Worlds setting, so I want to mimic as much as possible what they do in their books so that it's familiar for the Savage Worlds audience, right? So I like that too.
In a broader sense, what's your history with space opera? What kind of space opera triggers your imagination and, you know, keeps your focus?
It's hard to say what the biggest like influence like was, but certainly Larry Niven, Known Space series, mm-hmm. was a huge influence on me growing up. Today it doesn't quite hold up for me because there's so few women characters in his novels.
Yeah.
It really, really bothers me now. And yet, it was still an influence. I can't deny it. It's the
way it is. Oh, yeah. There's so many things where I'm like, I love this thing and it was formative, but then I look at it and I go, I can't anymore.
Yeah, I can't anymore. Like, I don't want to throw shade on anything, but I did try to read Ringworld Engineers recently, mm-hmm. and I couldn't stand it. I could not stand it because of the way he treated certain women characters, and it was so, I don't think he meant it, but it was just the way it was at that mm-hmm. time. And the ideas really captured my imagination. The idea of going in a general products hole to the center of the galaxy and, you know, tides and all that other stuff, like this sort of plausible, impossible stuff mm-hmm. that Larry Niven would dream up and then really just go into depth on. That's a huge influence. Otherwise, and I'm not sure, I guess that's space opera. I think it is. I think the later Known Space stuff.
It's a fuzzy genre, but I mean,
right,
I guess the way I usually think of it is it is more interested in the action or the adventure of science fiction than it is the hard mechanics of things.
Right. And certainly I think the when he gets into Known Space in the later years, I think it becomes more space opera than mm-hmm. his earlier stuff. And then Dune is a huge influence on me.
Oh,
and it's a huge influence on the Han Cluster.
Mm-hmm.
Star Trek, obviously. I mean, it's probably more than anything else. Star Trek is, my dad introduced me to the original series when I was a kid. And then I just went from there. And now, you know, I love the human stories coupled with a sci-fi story. I love the optimism of the setting. It's in my heart. Also, the remake of the Battlestar Galactica series. That's also heavily influential to me, and I love it. I don't like the way it ended, but I love the way the first few seasons were.
I had put off watching it for so long, and then during the pandemic, I watched it, which is possibly the worst time to watch
this. It's rough.
I would do like 2, maybe 3 episodes in a day, and I'd be like, yeah. I can't. I just can't anymore.
Yeah.
I like this, but I can't.
Right. Right. But that's just a few of, obviously, Star Wars. I think the biggest, my favorite Star Wars thing, and this is, I'm unusual in this way, is Rogue One. Mm-hmm. Rogue One is one of my very favorite Star Wars
movies. It is excellent, though. I mean, I love that one a lot. I think it came together very well. For Disney being very emphatic about things coming out on a schedule, for that being one of the first things that came out on that schedule, I think it just was phenomenal.
Yeah, yeah. And I loved Andor, too. So I just love it. Love it. Those are my favorite Star Wars properties, for sure.
And season 2 of Andor is coming up in March.
I know. I'm so excited.
What is the Han Cluster, and what is the Han Cluster role-playing game?
So the Han Cluster is an optimistic sci-fi role-playing game that really concentrates on connection. And I want to clarify, because this is something that I don't clarify enough. I think a lot of people hear optimism and they think there's nothing to do. Like all the problems are already solved, right? And that's just not what it is. That's not what the Han Cluster is. There are plenty of problems out there. We have largely gone past a lot of the current problems, you know, like the problems of diversity, problems of feeding people, all that kind of stuff. In that sense, it's very optimistic. We have a post-scarcity economy on at least 2 of the planets. Another one is trying, and then others still are not there yet, right? There's plenty of conflict, though, and it's sort of, it's both different conflict than we have and the same conflict. It's human conflict. And what I want to say about it is that optimism is not the absence of conflict. It's the attitude with which you face it. It's the fact that we can get through these horrific times or this really big problem, and we can go to the future with a sense of optimism, a sense that we are going to overcome, that we are going to make it past this. And the Han Cluster is designed from the ground up for illustrating this with the problems that you face and the people that you meet. And in a sense, it goes much deeper into the relationship-oriented aspects of role-playing, the building a coalition or building allies, and the fact that you can't exactly do what you're trying to do all by yourself. Mm-hmm. And yet, you are the ones who have to do it. There is nobody else who can do it. You have to do it. But you need help. And building those allies along the way is part of what the Han Cluster is all about.
It's funny because when you mention what is and isn't optimistic in a space opera science fiction story like that, it reminds me of some of the discussion that I saw recently over what the difference between the Section 31 movie was and Deep Space Nine. And people were saying, well, Deep Space Nine was dark and saying that all these things in the Federation were bad. And I was like, no, Deep Space Nine was still ultimately optimistic because it wasn't saying the Federation was wrong. It was saying that when things get tough, it is harder to live up to those things.
Yes, yes. That we still have the ideals. Even when the worst thing happens, we still believe enough that we can continue and move on. And we can still overcome. We can still be better. That's what I'm trying to capture. I mean, we're going to get into some of the unique things about the Han Cluster, but I also want to emphasize some of the familiar things, which is there's going to be fights. There's going to be social conflict type stuff. There's going to be all those, you know, like the crazy things that you do in role-playing games, defusing bombs or trying to calm a population or trying to do these crazy things that you do. It's all there. It's all there. And the stakes are really high, in fact. What I believe strongly in as far as writing role-playing games is to have the consequences of failure. Because that's as fun to me as a designer as it is as writing the triumphs. And I love to write the triumphs too. Like, it makes me cry to read the end of the plot point campaign, not only for the triumph if you win, but also for the tragedy if you don't. And what ultimately comes out of that is, even if you don't, and it's awful, like it's terrible, if you don't succeed at what you're trying to do, there's still hope. there's still a sense that there's we have a path forward. We have a way to move on from this and to keep going. That's what the Hunt Cluster is about.
It's interesting because when you mentioned the contrast between feeling like you have a massive setback and then having that triumph when you finally overcome that.
Yes.
You know, my thought immediately goes to, I was not a huge fan of Infinity War, but if you did not have the downbeat that Infinity War was, Endgame would not have been what it was.
Right. Exactly. And that's true in role-playing too. It's true because it's one of my core philosophies, because I've played enough games with really good GMs who know this, who say, okay, this is an overwhelming situation you're in right now in this campaign. What do you do? And we try to fight like heroes do. We say, oh no, we can overcome anything. We're heroes, right? And all of a sudden, things don't go well. The dice don't go our way. Things are bad. We've got to flee. We got to get out of there. And it feels like a huge loss. It feels like, oh man, that sucked. That really sucked. Like I wanted to be a hero in that moment, right? And you feel that disappointment as a player. But yet, I trust my GM and I trust the game. And we were given the opportunity to come back and get our revenge or make things right, you know, or come back in a better prepared way. And then that triumph when we do win, because of that tragedy that we had to run away before, is so much sweeter than it would have been without it. And it's sometimes hard to convince players of that. It's like the difference between giving players what they want and giving players what they need.
I remember I was playing through it was a Savage Worlds game, and it was, I cannot remember the name of the campaign right now, but it was a zombie apocalypse game. And every chapter ended with your sanctuary that you just set up getting completely trashed and you starting over again. And about the third time this happened, it was like, I'm sorry, I can't keep going with this because I'm not feeling enough of that. Someday this will work out.
Yes.
I'm just going to keep getting, you know, kicked over and over again when I'm down.
No, I get that too. I don't want that either. I don't want that either. It's, at some point you get kicked enough and you're just like, okay, that never mind. I don't really want to do this. Like, this is too, it's not like it's too real life, but it's, it doesn't give you that catharsis that you're looking for when you're playing the game.
But yeah, I absolutely agree. You do need people to have that feeling that everything was very, very bad and we have to get through this.
Yes, yes. It's a beautiful feeling, right? Whether it's long term, like four sessions ago, everything went to hell and now it was terrible. And now we have our chance to redeem ourselves. Or within the single fight, which Savage Worlds actually does kind of well, where you can feel like you're overwhelmed and things are going really badly. And yet somehow you pull it out because the dice explode at the right time or whatever. People are starting to figure stuff out and they start to coordinate. And all of a sudden you've got that triumph feeling, despite feeling like, oh my gosh, we're going to lose this. Like, we are going to lose. And the GM, if they know what they're doing, is sort of giggling in the corner because they know what you're capable of doing, even if you don't. Anyway, I'm rambling, but that's the kind of thing that I'm trying to capture.
Honestly, I love talking about products, but I also love talking about role-playing games. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this.
Right, exactly. Me too.
How is this going to be available? I know there is a crowdfunding that looks like it may be on the horizon. What are you looking to have this available? What formats in? You know, just some details on that.
The plan is to crowdfund. The initial date that I'd set, because you have to put a date in, was March 4th. It's not going to happen on March 4th right now because I'm still waiting for like two key pieces of art that I just can't go. I can't go without them. And so I'm waiting on those. I'm communicating with the artists and stuff, and it's coming slowly. So it's going to be a couple weeks, maybe. It may bleed into the beginning of April, but I don't see it going further than that because I am ready otherwise. I've got two full-sized books ready to go. I've got all the cards made up. I've got all the maps done. Everything is done. Except for a couple of like little, you know, the million things of the 1% of the, you know, you get to 99% and the 1% is the hardest. That's absolutely true. And that's where I'm at this point. But anyway, so a few weeks, you know, it'll be done when it's done, but that's the estimate at this point. And then what it will look like is dependent on the quote, because I plan to do an offset print run, which is really ambitious for somebody like me doing my first big crowdfunding. But I have help. I have people in my corner that makes this a little easier for me. So the plan is to do that, which means I think tiers will look like you can get the books separately. There's a source book. So everything for the players and for the GM to sort of run their own adventures or create their own stuff. And then there's an adventure book, which is just as big as the first book. And to me, it's the heart of the setting. Mm-hmm. So source book, adventure book, those will be available separately, both digitally and physically. And the idea is that I want to do a box set. So a box set will include both books, all the cards, which right now are numbering about 114 cards, which includes ally cards so that you can, and I don't want to spoil too much, but there are allies that you will get to play briefly during the plot point campaign, and adversary cards and edge cards and power cards and some other cards like campaign cards that the GM can hand out to the players to say, here's this cool thing, really important to the plot that you found, have it in front of you, you own it now, right? And then shift intensity cards, which I'll sort of get into in a minute, I imagine, which denotes where the shift intensity is at any given time. And there's this thing called the yellow shift, and we'll talk about it in a second. But all those cards will be included. I've got two full-size battle maps that I plan to do, one for the end of the plot point campaign and one for the middle of it or so. These really cool things I think that will work for different settings. So you could get those maps and use them for your own thing. And then finally, a map of the Han cluster itself. So those are that's my plan of what's going to be available. Mm-hmm. Both during the Kickstarter and after. And I plan to hopefully print enough that I'll be, you know, able to sell this stuff over the next couple of years and see what happens.
There have been a lot of very nice Savage World box sets in recent years.
I know there have. I'm not going full like Dice and Bennies, but I am trying to, I'm doing the same exact size. So the Savage World's book size will be my book size. So on the shelf, it'll match. The cards will be exactly the same. So recently there was the Sway 20th Anniversary Edition where they put out players boxes that are big enough to hold these cards that they've included also. And so I want you to be able to put my edge cards and my power cards in with the Savage World stuff so that you can include them in your players boxes as a player and just have it seamless, right? That's right. The idea.
That's very nice. That's kind of cool.
I'll also have digital figure flats. So I won't have pawns like Savage Worlds does because I think it might be too ambitious even for what I'm trying to do, but digital figure flats that you can print out and have on the table, both ghosted and physical versions of the figure flats. And we'll get into what that means. So anyway, I'll stop interrupting you now.
No, that's okay. You had basically touched on what I was going to ask about, and that is, yeah, I know that there's a lot of settings where a lot of story in Savage Worlds is summarized in plot points, and it sounds like there would be that, but there will also be a more traditional adventure book as well.
Yeah, the idea of the source book is it's everything the players need, obviously, to make characters and all that, and then everything the GM needs to understand the setting and what's going on behind the scenes. All the secrets are in the source book. The big mysteries of the setting are all revealed to the GM in the source book. The adventure book is all adventure. It's all the plot point campaign and all the Savage Tales and all the specific people that are associated with those things. To me, it's just as important because it really carries you through of the experience that I envisioned for Han Cluster. But you don't need it to play because the source book is there too.
In the Han Cluster RPG, you aren't playing just everyday people. You're playing people that are awakened, you know, to this greater thing. What exactly does that look like? What kind of people are you playing, and what have they been exposed to that they now understand?
In Han Cluster, we're basically 600 years in the future from where we are now. 300 years in the future, we decide we need to leave the planet because we've consumed it to death and we're in an ecological crisis and stuff. Now, don't worry, Earth survives. It actually does fine, but there's a whole thing that goes on between then. In that sort of intervening time when we send out colony ships to a cluster of stars called the Han Cluster, where they believe there are multiple habitable planets, they've unlocked a strange sort of adjacent dimension to reality called the Nex. And it's called the Nexus, but everybody calls it the Nex for short. That's how it's referred to in the book. And basically, it's, like I said, an adjacent dimension to reality. After we've unlocked it, and we don't know why it's unlocked, we don't know how it became unlocked, but it became unlocked shortly after we arrived in the Han Cluster. Everybody in human space, all humans, could detach what's called their exos from their physical body. And their exos, it's like astral projection, except that their exos are not non-corporeal, they're semi-corporeal. So they still will bump against walls, they can't walk through walls, or they can still interact with the physical world. It in game parlance, it causes a penalty when they do it. So they have an interaction penalty. So if you're trying to play the piano or pick a lock or try, you know, anything physical in the real world, mm-hmm. as your semi-corporeal ex-ghost, you'll have a -2 to that activity, right? But because you're slippery and sort of like non-corporeal, not all the way, or semi-corporeal, not all the way there. The important thing about that is like every human can do it. They can detach their ex-ghost, every one of them, not just the heroes. The difference between the regular people in the Hun cluster and the heroes, though, is that there's also this thing called ex-bonding, where through an event of stress or connection or unusual emotional attachment or whatever, two people or more, in the case of the PC group, can become ex-bonded together. And what that means is they can mentally communicate with each other at all times, no matter what distance they are apart. So you could be on one planet, your ex-bonded mate could be on another planet. You can immediately and instantly communicate mentally with that person all the time. You can also send your ex-ghost directly to that person. And because it's semi-corporeal, you still have the ability to do stuff. And so the idea of splitting the party in the Hun cluster is a completely different animal than in any other role-playing game. Because not only are you always in tune with what's going on, like in game. Mm-hmm. So table talk is absolutely a thing. Like if the PCs are all ex-bonded together, or they will be in the first adventure of the Plot Point campaign. And if somebody's doing something on the planet Edenic and somebody else is on the planet Chaste, that person on Edenic could be talking to somebody else and the one on Chaste could give input on what's happening. Because what I assume is that everybody's telling everybody what's going on unless you specifically say you're not. Mm-hmm. Right. And you can hold stuff back and, you know, refuse reception of those communications. But I assume you're all going to talk to each other. So table talk is a thing. So the player on the opposite side of the table who's actually is on Chaste can still talk and have ideas and throw things out there for the group to chew on, right? And if necessary, they can ghost travel to their ex-bonded mate and participate. They'll have special weapons called ex-weapons that they can manifest both when they're physical and when they're ex-ghosted, but those weapons travel with them when they ghost travel. And they have tools they can use like ex-data pads and all this stuff, so it's all available to you. The Jumpstart adventure is all about this. It starts you in different places in the Hun cluster, days away from each other from hyperspace travel, and you're trying to solve a cluster-wide crisis that is happening in three different locations. So people are ghost traveling to each other in different places at different times throughout the adventure, trying to solve this problem, investigate it, and figure out what's going on. And then there's some fights that go on, so people can ghost travel to their friends, help them with the fight, and then ghost travel back to their niece who's on Onyx while there's riots going on. Mm-hmm. And it's a very sort of frenetic adventure that introduces you to all these iconic aspects of the Hun cluster. And the reason, it's not the reason, but it all ties into that theme of connection and mm-hmm. that we're all in this together, right? Like we are working together and we are inseparable. As both PC group and the human race, like there's a collective consciousness there, and the next is sort of pulling us together. That's a long answer to your question of who you're playing, and the other aspect to that is that each of these PCs have an immunity to what's called the yellow shift, and the yellow shift is the main problem of the setting. Like this is the big thing that you're trying to deal with. There is a weird. It's not a virus, but there it is. It is sort of compared to a virus, where everybody in human space is starting to get more agitated and angry and irrational and paranoid and all this stuff, sort of gradually. And the PCs are immune to this effect. They're called all the way blue. They see it going on, and they see it not only in a behavioral sense, but in a color sense, because the auras of everybody's ex-ghosts are changing color to them. They're drifting from blue to blue-green, to green, toward yellow. That's why it's called the yellow shift. And the worse it gets, the more angry and irrational people get. The end game of the yellow shift is shift intensity 6, where everybody is so out of their minds that they're basically killing each other. The Plot Point campaign is all about trying to stop the yellow shift and finding assets, allies to do it. And the PCs are immune, and they're ex-bonded together. This puts them in a very unique position to be able to solve this problem.
So what you're saying is when people have a community and a support structure, it helps them in And time
it does.
Like that.
In fact, I've got a setting rule called community connection, where when you do something significant, right? When you help somebody, or, you know, do something for the community that helps, or defeat a bad guy or whatever, sometimes that in itself will sort of galvanize a community together. But sometimes you need to do something to galvanize the community after you've done the thing. And either way, the community connection setting rule, the idea behind it is that you do something together, that you bring people together and say, you know, you are angry. You are under shift intensity 3 for, you know, all this time, and we're here to help and all this stuff. And if you can bring them together and sort of give them hope and see that they're not alone from some event, it could be a party, it could be a hike, it could be an atmospheric flying competition, whatever you want to organize, right? And then you're successful doing it, you'll lower the local shift intensity of that area. And it could be lowered by 1 or 2 levels, depending on how well you do. So it's sort of built in to the game from a mechanic standpoint, not only a narrative standpoint, but you're trying to bring people together. And when you bring people together, the yellow shift reduces. It will never go away until you figure out how to inoculate people against it. And that's what the plot point campaign is about.
So I'll be the terrible person and ask, what happens if a person's original physical body dies while they are an ex-ghost somewhere else?
They die.
Okay.
I have videos that are already up on YouTube, on the Hung Cluster YouTube channel. There's 4 of them. They're pretty brief. They're 3-4 minutes each. And they go over some of the iconic aspects, like what ex-ghosts are, what ex-bonding is, what Draxel communication is. And that's a whole thing about how you instantly communicate without an ex-bond for everybody else. Mm-hmm. And finally, wounds and healing. So when you take a wound as an ex-ghost, it automatically transfers to your sleeper, which is wherever your physical body is, right? Could be on another planet. Somehow, it automatically transfers. The only way to heal wounds is to heal the physical body. You can't heal an ex-ghost. That gets into a complicated thing about paying attention to where your physical body is, who's got access to it, and how you can get help if things go badly. So if your ex-ghost dies, you die. If your body dies, you die. If somehow they're linked, they're always constantly linked. The way healing works is that you have to heal the physical body, not the ex-ghost. And so it makes for interesting choices and for unusual things. Like, it's better if you carry on your physical body all the med kits and metagels, mm-hmm, and restoration gels with you, rather than have the doctor carry it for you, because the doctor has to ghost into your physical body to help you. They can't bring that stuff with them. All they can do is bring X gear. So they can bring a meta scanner that's an X gear item, mm-hmm, but they can't bring the gel that will help them make you better. So if you have it on your person, then it's already there for them. So it's an interesting thing. And those videos sort of explain this.
This is just a self-serving, really silly thing to ask, but how hard do you envision running some of these things in Theater of the Mind? And the only reason I ask that is back when I got into running Savage Worlds for a while, way back in 2011, I had been so burned out on miniatures, I just did not want to get anything, mm-hmm, out and put it on a table at,
sure,
all.
Sure. In my opinion, it runs equally well both ways. And I say that with experience, because I've playtested the plot point campaign multiple times in multiple iterations. Sometimes those playtests have been in person. Sometimes they've been online over Discord. The latest 2, the first one was over Discord, completely Theater of the Mind. I didn't have any VTTs going, nothing like that. All I had was people rolling their own dice, carrying their own character sheets. And we did a lot of quick encounter stuff. And that's a mechanic in Savage Worlds. Mm-hmm. We did a lot of dramatic task stuff. We did a lot of social encounters, because that's all built into the adventures. Even did a mass battle. None of that requires miniatures, mm-hmm, on the table. However, I love miniatures on the table. I love the combat in Savage Worlds, right? It's very tactical. It allows me to do a lot of things, mm-hmm, that you can't do in a Theater to Mind sort of situation. So the next playtest I did was with Shane Hensley and Daryl Hayhurst and Simon and those guys from Savage Worlds at the table. Full-on tactical combats, everything, like even with ship combat and stuff like that. It all worked just fine. I have all the stats in there for it. Right. And the setting rules kind of give you hints about how to deal with these things if you want a simpler experience. Right. Mm-hmm. So if you don't want to go full on tactical for space combat, just do it as a quick encounter or a dramatic task. And, you know, here's some pointers on how to do that. And then so I think it works equally well because Hung Cluster is not just about combat. It is a lot about social stuff, and there's plenty of variety of what you're trying to do that will engage you outside of just hitting each other with X swords or shooting each other with pistols. But there's plenty of that too, if you want. Like, I love that stuff. So I want exciting. I want all of that.
What's funny is I kind of came full circle because in 2011, I was so burned out on it. Now, I was also never going to use the VTT, and then COVID laughed at me. But I do like, you know, having that tactical feel, but also sometimes things just emerge in the middle of a game and I don't want to set up a map to resolve what's going on there, but it still feels like it is something that should be mechanically resolved, not just hand waved. So
sure. And that's, I mean, that's the beauty of quick encounters, right? Mm-hmm. Especially in Savage Worlds is, okay, pick a skill. What do you do? You pick a skill. What do you do? Now roll your dice. And if you fail, you know, we'll figure out how it goes and we'll tell the story based on how you did, you know, and if it's dangerous, you might get a wound. Right. So it's, mm-hmm. it's still mechanically, it's got bite mechanically still, and there's stakes there, but it can go very, very fast. You don't have to go and pull out miniatures and a map and set it all up.
I know one of the first things that I noticed when I looked at the most recent edition of Savage Worlds was that as somebody that really loved in Edge of the Empire, mm-hmm. the Star Wars game, there is a section on, like, here is how you just resolve a scene if you don't want to have like stats for everybody and play it out and everything. And that's great because once in a while you want the players to have a shootout when they're trying to get to their ship.
Yes.
But you don't want to have statistics for every single, you know, bounty hunter and it's just this is a scene where people are shooting at you. What happens as they're shooting at you and you're running for the ship?
Right. Or all of a sudden they're gonna go steal something. They're gonna plot a heist that you had not planned for at all. Yes. Right. And you're like, okay, heist it is then. And now I don't have to figure out exactly what's in your way or what the mechanics are of that. All I have to do is say quick encounter heist. What do you do to get, I set up the scene. I say, mm-hmm. this is the place you're trying to infiltrate. Basically, you know, it has fences here, blah, 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 stuff that you can make up easily. And then what do you do to get in? How do you help? Are you security? Are you hacking? Are you breaking in? Are you sneaking around? Are you fighting? What are you doing? And then that determines the story of how they did it. And it's all very fast.
Mm-hmm. I'll also throw this out there since you mentioned it. The mass combat rules in Savage Worlds are some mm-hmm. of the few that I actually really kind of liked using in a mm-hmm. game.
Yeah. I love them. Very few other games do it at all, but Savage Worlds allows you to do it quickly and with high stakes.
Mm-hmm.
And all you have to do is set the scene a little bit and start to and think about exactly kind of what commanders have at their disposal, what they don't, and then assign some bonuses and give people a chance to react to what is happening. And it all can happen very fast. Like it doesn't have to be this all night mass mm-hmm. battle thing. People are going to run away eventually, right? But that's what mass battles are. And you can do them in Hunkla. So there's several that are set up as a possibility. You don't have to do it that way. Mm-hmm. But if you want to, you can. All the ship stuff is there.
I won't go off on too much of a tangent here, but at one point in time, it occurred to me that every starfighter fight in a Star Wars game should actually be a chase because it is very rare for people to try to just blow the other side up completely. It's almost always... Right.
You're
rebels
not just
running
like,
away from,
you know,
someone.
Head to head shooting at each other. And that's how sort of Savage Worlds handles it. It's mm-hmm. always, it's all a chase. Right?
Yeah.
And you'll fight, you'll fire, but usually somebody's trying to get away from somebody else.
Mm-hmm. So if there was one thing that you wanted people to take away from all of this and to remember after listening to this, before the crowdfunding starts, to cement in their minds why they want this, why they want to explore this, what would it be?
Well, I hope people will look at it as something unique in the sense that it's optimistic. And what I mean by optimism is that it's there's conflict, but it's the attitude we have about that conflict that makes it optimistic. I want you to understand that it's unique in the sense there's Exkos and you have much different ways of interacting at the table, but it's also familiar in the sense that there are conflicts, there are things to do, there's lots to do, and what I love most about it are some of the characters that you meet along the way and the building of coalitions and that triumph at the end. Like I say, I wrote it, and when I read it back, I missed up because I'm so touched mm-hmm. by it.
So I know crowdfunding is a major undertaking, but do you have any other projects going on beyond the Han Cluster or any recent projects you'd like to talk about?
Well, I currently host a podcast of my own. So it's called Designing Problems, and I host it with my friend Christian Serrano. And we basically are attempting to give people motivation and empowerment to design and put out, not just design your own games and adventures and systems even, but actually share them with other people, not only for no money, but to producing, right? Mm-hmm. So we're covering everything from the design of it, the mental roadblocks that are on the way, like imposter syndrome mm-hmm. and all that other stuff that comes up when you're trying to do this, the support that you need. Because believe me, doing a crowdfunding campaign like this and putting out a book that basically encapsulates 400 some odd pages is a major undertaking for one person. You need support. And part of the reason that we started the Designing Problems podcast was to offer you that support, give you a look behind the curtain that a lot of other people don't give you of how to do some of these things, and do it in a, like Concluster, an optimistic and empowering way, not mm-hmm. a don't do this gatekeeping way, right? So anyway, Designing Problems, it's available on almost all podcast platforms.
All right. The Gnomecast is part of the Polygamerist Podcast Network, so if you're enjoying us, here's another show you should check out. Panda's Talking Games, queer gamers talking about tabletop role-playing games and making outtakes. Join Panda's Phil and Senda every Wednesday answering listener questions about playing, running, and designing TTRPGs. It's like Car Talk, but for your games. You can find all of us at gnomestew.com, as well as Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, and Threads. Is there any place that you would like people to be able to check you out, Tracy?
I have Designing Problems. We have our own Discord server. So if you listen and look at the show notes, you can go there and you can interact with me directly. Honcluster has its own Discord server. It's not hard to find. Honcluster has its own website. Not hard to find. And then of course, BackerKit is coming probably in the next few weeks. So, there's all kinds of places to find me. All you have to do is Google Tracy Sizemore and you'll find me.
All right. Before we leave, is there anything you want to give a shout out to?
Well, as of this recording, tomorrow, and I don't know when this will be out, but hopefully within the next few weeks, Lost Colony, the Mad World, which is an expansion for the Lost Colony franchise, written by my dear friend Daryl Hayhurst, who I've known since the first grade, is coming out on Kickstarter, or I think BackerKit, actually. And so it may still be running when we release this. We'll see.
All right. One of the things that I wanted to bring up since we were talking about Savage Worlds is sometimes it is really hard when you are using those tactical maps to find something that represents either modern day figures or science fiction or things of that nature. And Pinnacle, the publishers of Savage Worlds, actually have been putting out more and more pawn sets. So they have ones for modern horror and supers and other genres. So those might be something you want to check out if you are playing in a tactical game and you're having a hard time finding things of the right genre. So I'm going to put a link in the show notes for the page for the RPG accessories for Studio 2 Publishing, and you can check those out. Tracy, thank you for being on the show, not just because you're an excellent guest, but because nobody would throw a guest in the stew, and surely they would never toss an interviewer in there.
Well, again, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure to be here, and I've listened to the Gnomecast. I've read Gnome Stew, and I'm a little bit of a fangirl, so thank you very much.